Hi, I'm Bede Hill, and this is The D Word, the show where we talk dementia. Welcome along to another D Word here on UK Health Radio. Good to have you company. Now, being a dementia caregiver is one of the most undervalued and vital roles. For many, it's like working a 36-hour day, which is the title of the best-selling book my guest this week, Dr. Beda Rabins, first wrote in 1981. It's now into its 8th edition and is every bit as relevant today as it was then. Beda will be joining me right after this from Danny Burns.
From up here when the sky's clear, you can see Georgia looking south. But I'd have to climb in a spaceship to find California, ain't no doubt. You're too far away from your Carolina home. Your goodbye left me all alone. I'm high on this mountain, tonight I'm looking down on the lights of your used to be Carolina town. The sun is still shining where you are up west, but I'm in the dark with this pain in my chest, heartbroken missing you. Think of me. Get lost on the river road winding where tall pines are growing. Kind of memory. Well, I had to drive on to get here tonight. Alone and it didn't feel right. I'm high on this mountain. Tonight I'm looking down. So you used to be Carolina town. The sun is still shining where you are always, but I'm in the dark with this pain in my chest, heartbroken missing you.
Danny Burns and Blue Ridge Blue. My guest this week is Dr. Beda Rabins, Richmond Family Professor for Alzheimer's and Related Diseases and Director of the Geriatric Psychiatry Program in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioural Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. So what got Beda started in this area of medicine?
When I was a medical student, I was interested both in psychiatry and also the brain, neurology, and trying to figure out how could you put those two together. And I came to learn that there are a lot of diseases that we consider brain diseases. that have psychological and psychiatric symptoms. So Alzheimer's disease was one of them. And what really got me interested specifically in Alzheimer's disease was the needs of the caregiver. I just very quickly found that I could help both the person with the disease and the family. And for me, that was an important realization.
And we're talking early 1980s here, aren't we? And even mention of the word Alzheimer's, I guess, had a lot of people just saying, "What's that?"
Yeah, not a lot of people, including doctors, nurses, and social workers, would not have heard of it. Yeah, that's correct, at the beginning of my career.
And the book, The 36-Hour Day, I mean, it's now on to edition number 8, but it came around originally in 1981, I understand. And what kind of prompted a book in 1981 of a subject that not a lot of people knew about?
Well, it's partly what you asked in the last question, that people tended to think of getting old as becoming forgetful and being unable to care for yourselves. And so one of the points was to say, no, with normal aging, people can be independent and function well, but there are diseases that impair people. So that was the first message. We wanted people to know that it's a disease. That causes forgetfulness and inability to care for oneself. But then, second, that in spite of the fact that we had no specific treatments, there are many things that the person and the family could do to make their lives better. So those were the sort of the two messages at the beginning.
So did that come as news to people at the beginning? Because dementia can be looked at as a dark subject. There is no cure. And was it kind of thought as a bit of a life sentence then?
Yes, and I think many people said to me and others who were interested at the time, see, you can't do anything about it anyways. What does it matter what you call it? And so again, I think it was to counter that, to instill some realistic optimism. Again, we can't fix the disease, we can't stop it even today, but there is a lot to do to make the quality of life better for the person with the disease and their loved ones.
And the title, 36-Hour Day, where did that come from?
It actually came from a family member, not that I was involved with, but someone who reviewed the book when it was being written, said, I heard this phrase from a person in Seattle, Washington. So that's the opposite coast from Baltimore, where I was. And it captured the challenges that many people, family members felt. So it was such a catchy title. We said, yes, that's what we'll call it.
Well, it's sold over 4 million copies, so it was a very good title. And I've read it. It's very comprehensive, but whilst it's being comprehensive, it also it's not a textbook to me. It's something that's eminently readable and something that people can drop in and drop out of. Was that the kind of intention?
Yeah, absolutely. First, we believe and still do that giving people information is important. And so we wanted people to know, and still now, what's the up-to-date science? What are doctors and nurses and others interested? What do we know about the disease? But again, at the same time, to realize that it really has a strong emotional impact on people. And so we were trying to address both of those issues simultaneously. It has gotten a lot bigger over time, partly because we know so much more, not just about the biology and the medications and all that, but again, how to care for people. And so it does keep getting bigger. That worries me a little bit. It's a little too big. But as you said, for most people, looking in the index and finding what is it that your loved one is dealing with, or if you're have early disease? What is it that you're worried about? To look at the index and just read that part of it. So some people want to read the whole book, and many others, I think, just look at the specific piece that's relevant to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're surrounded by information, aren't we? Both in book form on the internet. And if you're a caregiver, to actually have all that information in one place is really important to you because you don't want to spend time searching here, there, and everywhere, different books, different websites, etc.
Well, thanks for saying that, because that's exactly what our purpose was, to try to put everything in one place.
The station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Remember when I used to see you passing by, and it's
Pogo staring at the sky here on the D Word, when we're fast approaching 300 shows since we began in 2019. And I've got something special to mark the milestone with the first half of a football and dementia special with my guest, former professional football and rugby league player Roy Heaney. That'll be coming up on November 17th. This week I'm talking to Dr. Peter Rabins about the book, The 36-Hour Day. And, I mean, the way it starts off, I always look at a book that kind of grabs the reader and gets them into the book and continue it. And it's not like any other book on sort of dementia from a medical perspective that I've ever read, because we get the story of Mrs. Windsor. And we get a lady who fears she may be developing Alzheimer's, and we go through her story before we actually get into the book. And I think it's a really clever way of getting people into the book.
Well, thank you. And, you know, we did it for that reason, but also it's easy to dehumanize the person with dementia, to just think of them as forgetful or needing help or whatever. And we wanted to present it as a person who has a problem that everyone can relate to or, you know, empathize with. And so it was those sort of those two things that led us to put that right at the beginning.
And also, I think it's very powerful, those real life stories, isn't it? Because, you know it's great writing something down and saying your loved one may do this. But when you've actually got a story of someone and a person, as you say, it really kind of identifies it.
Yeah, I think that's true for all of us, that we relate to individual stories very strongly. That's part of what makes us human, I think. So I'm glad to hear you say that, because that was an important goal of ours.
And I think that, you know, there's a real frame in the book, which is basically a look at the person, not the disease. That's where this program came from, because when I worked for the Alzheimer's Society here in the UK, I used to manage activity groups of people living with dementia in the community. And before we actually went into our groups, which were in church halls, community centres, I always used to say, you do know that the word we don't mention in that, once we get in there, is the D word. And people look at me and say, why? And I said, well, why do I go into a room full of people that are living with dementia and say that's Dennis with dementia or Iris with dementia? First of all, it's Dennis and Iris.
Yeah, you know, and of course, that's not just Alzheimer's disease. I mean, we talk about diabetics and schizophrenics. And I think we have to work very hard to not just identify people as by the disease that they happen to be experiencing or suffering from. And we have to work at it.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's various things of working with dementia. The prominent question, 6 years doing this show, and I'm still asked, what's the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia?
And that's a question everywhere I go. And in fact, anytime I give a public talk or a medical talk, that's the very first thing I go over. I say, let's define the terms here. And I may slip up and use dementia when I mean Alzheimer's disease and vice versa. But they're two very different terms. And, you know, that the term dementia refers to any disease that impairs an adult's thinking, but doesn't impair how alert they are, and goes on to affect their everyday life. Alzheimer's happens to be the most common cause of that, but there are about 100 other illnesses that cause similar symptoms. And so at one level, the label doesn't matter. If we're thinking about care, many of the principles are the same across all the diseases that cause dementia. But again, and this is one of the themes of the book, I think it is useful to know the particular diagnosis if you can, because different diseases have different symptoms. And it does help people in a good way, I think, feel that they have a little bit of control over things if they understand, well, why does this person not recognize me, or why are they seeing visions? And to know that those come from the disease, and here's what we've learned about how to manage that particular symptom and that particular disease.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because I had a cancer diagnosis 3 years ago, and the first thing anybody asks you when you've had a cancer diagnosis is, which type? And yet, with a dementia diagnosis, it doesn't tend to follow, does it?
That's true. No, that's a good observation. You know, and I also say to people, it's a little bit like the term heart failure. Again, we know there are many, many causes of heart failure. And of course, it's important because the different causes have different treatments. So dementia, it means brain failure, just as heart failure means there's something wrong with how the heart is working.
And the other thing I liked in the book was there's a phrase, and you know, it's a big book. There was a phrase that really resonated with me that said that don't read this expecting a problem to develop. And it's a bit like, the old story. If you read the medical dictionary, then you're suffering from all the things that you've just read. And just because, you are reading this book, there may be other reasons.
Yes. Again, thanks for mentioning that, because I think that's very important. Again, in thinking about the person with the disease, of course, they have other illnesses. The environment's very different from one person to the next. And so not treating everything in their life as caused by or related to Alzheimer's disease is very important.
And I think the other important thing in terms of caregivers is that you're not always going to get it right. It's a very difficult thing, but people, and there's a little bit in the book about guilt, and that people tend to beat themselves up, but there's no right or wrong answer to some of this.
Yes. And, some of the research that I did in the past on caregivers, we actually compared caregivers of people with advanced cancer to people caring for somebody with Alzheimer's disease. And we found that for the caregivers, the distress levels were similar and many of the feelings they had. But the one difference was much more guilt in people who were caring for someone with Alzheimer's disease than someone with cancer. And I think it's partly what you said, that the caregiver gets in the position of not knowing what to do or feeling that they have to do things that they wouldn't normally do. It's hard to tell your parent they can't drive, they can't go out for a walk because they're too forgetful. And I think all those things do induce guilt. And trying to help people put that in perspective and the challenges in perspective, that's one of the goals of the book. You can't get away from the frustration sometimes. We can't, again, cure the disease, and sometimes it just seems like it's relentlessly progressive. But helping people realize they actually are doing the best that anyone could, I think that's an important message. But everybody fails. I mean, we all fail, and that is hard. It's one of the things that makes it hard to be a caregiver.
Kelly Willis, I know better now on UK Health Radio. We have some great new shows, including There's a Walk for That, with my friend Harriet Thomas, who's actually appeared on this show in the past. It's a show about discovering how walking can transform your body, lift your mood, and reconnect you with yourself. So do give it a listen. All our shows are up for listen again and download at UKHealthRadio.com. Back to my guest now, Dr. Beta Rabins.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing as well is you do get a feeling that as a caregiver reading it, you're not on your own. And also, I like the kind of involvement of the family, friends, how people might react, etc. Because that's all really important. You know, and it's kind of bringing the whole picture of support together.
Yeah, we tried to write it as if we were having a conversation with one caregiver or one person with a disease. I don't know that we always succeeded, but that was one of our goals. And, you know, you said something else I think is so important, that every person with a disease is affected differently and every caregiver approaches it somewhat differently. And so that's a challenge too. How do you write one book for many people? And so emphasizing the variability in the disease and how people react, I think is important. Saying that there's no one normal way that the disease progresses. There's no one, quote, normal way that caregivers do feel or should feel. You're an individual. And we tried to convey that both in the way we wrote it and in the information we provided.
Yeah, because it's a tough one, really, isn't it? Because we're kind of brought up in terms of illness for go to the doctor will give you a pill and you'll feel better. We're just not kind of programmed, I guess, to accept the variability of a condition where you can have two people who react completely differently.
Yes, and that's really true for every illness. You know, that's not unique to those that cause dementia or to Alzheimer's, but the cancer, of course, varies tremendously. And so, again, it's sort of every medical condition affects individuals differently. And the same thing with their loved ones and their caregivers. And taking that into account and trying to help the whole spectrum of individuals, that's part of what makes it a challenge, I think, that sometimes people compare themselves to another person caring for someone, another carer. And again, that's probably a mistake. Knowing yourself and getting the help you need, if any, is a very important message.
Yeah, and I think, it comes across very well. I mean, in terms of kind of broadening it out a bit, in terms of diagnosis, we're probably looking at something that develops a couple of years before people really start to notice. And it's very, very difficult, isn't it, for a caregiver. And also, does that come into the guilt bit again, thinking, I did notice that a couple of years ago, but I didn't do anything about it?
Yes, I think many people feel, if only I had said something or recognized this as just not normal aging. I think the best thing one can do is talk about that openly and read into it. Even today, the average person takes about 2 years from first symptom to be diagnosed. Hopefully we'll shorten that. But at the beginning, it's just so hard to know. What is usual aging? What is a disease? So as tests get better, perhaps we'll do a little bit better at that. But that is a challenge.
And I guess as tests do get better, you know, we're talking about things like blood tests, etc. now, I guess that opens up a whole raft of things as well. Because when I sort of thought, you know, you go for a blood test and you're feeling generally okay, and suddenly your blood test tells you that maybe you're not. And it's kind of how to carry that forward and that information, because that information may be more dangerous than actually not knowing
That is absolutely true. And again, it's true for screening for many diseases. And again, to use cancer as an example, now that we're developing better and better tests for screening, people are truly being diagnosed earlier. But it's not clear that that has a long-term benefit, that often people have the cancer for the same percentage of time or the same number of months or years going forward. They've just been detected earlier. There is something unique about the test for Alzheimer's disease, whether it's a blood test or spinal fluid test or a PET brain scan, and that is that the test itself doesn't make the diagnosis. So if you are normal in your thinking, the tests right now don't have any meaning. They don't tell us whether you do or don't have the disease. It's only if you have symptoms and a positive blood test, spinal fluid test, et cetera, that we make the diagnosis. Now, I think that's going to change over time, that we'll become better at it. So it's important that people who are well, as far as their thinking go, not get tested, because many people over the age of 70 have the abnormal protein, the amyloid beta protein, in their brain, but are normal. And now that many people are living to 100, it's even the case there that there are 100-year-olds who are seemingly totally normal who are testing positive. And we don't know whether that means eventually they would have gotten it, Alzheimer's disease, or there are people who can live with the abnormal proteins, and the body knows ways to minimize or totally avoid the negative symptoms. So all this has to get worked up over time.
So, it's an amazingly interesting field. I mean, when you're looking at that, things like mild cognitive impairment, if you say to somebody, this is a mild cognitive impairment, do they automatically think, oh no, it's going to develop into dementia?
That's true. And it is true that if you have mild cognitive impairment, you're at greater risk. About 10% of people with that do develop dementia of some sort every year in the future. But interestingly enough, 20 or 25% of people who were first diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment go back to normal. So they were having a bad day, they had a cold. Their medication was having an interaction. They didn't sleep very much last night. They were nervous about the doctor's appointment. I think it's been an important concept in a positive way to raise people's attention that what they're experiencing isn't imaginary or whatever. But it just means we really need to follow you carefully to see whether this is going to progress into something more serious, or get better, or remain the same for the next 5 years. And all those are possibilities.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And I guess that kind of decision to start with is whether to get diagnosed is a very personal one, isn't it?
Well, I think so, but I will say that There's certainly experts who think everybody who might have a problem should be recognized early. My feeling is we still don't have good enough treatments to say that we should be screening everybody and making a diagnosis whenever, as early as possible. I do think for many people they would like that, and I think there are good reasons to do it so that we can talk with our loved ones about what we would like to happen to us if we do develop Alzheimer's or a similar progressive disease that ultimately might rob us of the ability to make good decisions. And so many people need to be pushed to have those conversations. And I think the hope, the thought is, well, having an early diagnosis would encourage people to do that. But there are unique things about Alzheimer's disease, one of which is that it seems to block some people's awareness that they have a problem. And so very early diagnosis for those people may not be helpful, that many people say, well, all my friends have the same problems, or I don't feel anything out of the ordinary, so I don't need help. So I think until we have better treatments, I totally agree with you. I think it should be an individual choice. I do think if people want to know, they should be carefully assessed.
Sure. And I guess in terms of anything you may inherit as well, then that's really your choice. You know, if you've got a 50% chance, then it's your choice, I guess, whether you want to know or not.
Yes, and we've learned that, excuse me, from another cause of dementia, a rare disease called Huntington disease, in which the gene, the single gene, was actually discovered 20 years ago. And so that means there's been a gene test available for that particular disease, and it's inherited in what's called an autosomal dominant way, which means if one of your parents has it, you have a 50% chance of getting it. And what's developed over time is that as that test has become 100% accurate, fewer people have actually wanted the test. So now somewhere around two-thirds or perhaps only a half of people in a family where that disease exists want to be tested. And I think you're right. We have to acknowledge that that's the individual's choice.
Yeah, most certainly. I mean, in terms of, you know, new drug treatments that are coming on, the kind of media perspective is probably over the last couple of years, things have really accelerated. Do you see that acceleration as continuing, or, you know, have we kind of hit another stage where we're going to have to wait a bit to move forward?
Yeah, my personal opinion is that these new medicines that have been developed and approved somewhat in the last few years, variable across different countries, are a huge advance in that they really do seem to change what's happening in the brain. They remove the abnormal protein called amyloid beta, and it's very likely that there are medicines in trial now because there's a second abnormal protein called the tau protein. But these medicines, the current drugs, are only about 7% effective, meaning if you take it, on average, you improve by 7%. It doesn't stop the disease from progressing, and there are serious side effects. But I think this is a start, and now that we know that we can change the biology, I think going forward, it's going to be like cancer, where for some cancers, you need to take four drugs because each one does something different. And I think that's likely the case here.
And I think, you know, going back to the book in terms of caregivers, obviously, you know, the back of the book tells you about the new research, etc., and you know, gives you a kind of idea of what's coming. But I guess the message that comes out of the book as well is that that's all happening, but don't forget that there's a lot of really positive things you can do now to make life better.
Yes, I think, again, that's the central message of the book, realistic optimism. It's still a terrible disease. It does disable and really debilitate people. But there are lots of things that we can try. And I think one of the other challenges in this regard is that it's a trial and error process. So there may be a problem, either for the caregiver or the person with the disease, and you try three things and they really haven't helped. Well, what's number four? What's number five? Or are there two things we should be doing? And so helping people realize that it's trial and error and persistence that sometimes, usually, I think, help. That's an important message, and not to ignore that and only focus on the fact, oh, now we have a medicine. And again, yeah, that's true for people with other diseases as well. Yes, the fact that we have therapies is important, but most severe diseases affect people's lives in every facet of it. And we want to support them emotionally and with education, and if they have pain, we want to be treating that no matter what the cause, et cetera. So it's a general principle of care, but we'd love there to be one pill that would make everything go away.
Well, one day, hopefully, you know, that'll occur. But in the meantime, I mean, we're kind of running out of time, which is really sad, but it's sold 4 million copies. It's in the 8th edition. When edition number 9 comes out, it's obviously going to get a bit bigger. But, you know, what do you hope that you'll be able to include in that?
I hope that if there's a 9th edition, the reason will be is because we have much better biological treatments. I think we've been able to revise it enough to address many of the care issues, and there may be new things that we'll learn, and of course they should be included. But I think the hope now is on two fronts. Number one is prevention, and we're learning how to at least delay its onset or perhaps slightly lessen how common it is. And that's one of the things that people need to be mindful of. It's that what's called the incidence rate, the number of new cases per 100 or 1,000 people is going down. So prevention is already working, and we're going to find better and better ways to prevent the disease. So that, I think, would be a reason to revise it. And second, I think there will be better biological treatments, I think, going forward, and they may be totally different medicines. We still don't really understand the cause of the disease, and that's why we need to be doing more research. Yes, these abnormal proteins occur in the brain and accumulate, but what triggers them to be deposited in the brain? We don't know that yet. So I think advances in biology and advances in prevention, those are the things that would justify having a new edition.
Oh, yeah. I think it's definitely justified anyway. But when you talk about prevention, I think it's quite interesting that a lot of the things that have come out probably relatively recently for the public anyway in terms of prevention are things in terms that it's almost like look after your heart, look after your brain. You know, it's not stuff that's unexpected. Don't smoke, don't drink, fatty foods, etc.
Yes, I think that emphasizes the fact that somehow the blood vessels are involved in cardiovascular disease and brain other than stroke, but also in Alzheimer's. And, you know, to emphasize prevention, the single most important thing that your listeners can do is get their high blood pressure treated, no matter what age. It looks like getting high blood pressure treated in your 40s can prevent about 20% of Alzheimer's disease in your 70s and 80s. So these changes in diet, exercise, and high blood pressure control, they need to start in middle age. And hopefully that will motivate people, all people, but particularly people who have it in their family to act as early as they can to change their diet, get their blood pressure treated, get all their cardiovascular risk factors treated. I think that's a really important message.
Yeah, I think it's a message of a hope as well, that if you are in your 40s, then okay, there's something here you can do about this. And I think that's really important. Well, Pete, it's been absolutely fascinating. We'll have to get you back onto the show and talk some more as things develop. The book is excellent. I recommend it to anybody. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, Pete. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks to Peter. The book, The 36-Hour Day, A Family Guide to Caring for People with Alzheimer's Disease, Other Dementias and Memory Loss, was written along with Nancy L. Mace and published by John Hopkins Press, and it's available from all major book outlets. That's all for this week. Thanks to Angela, my production assistant. Next week, my guest will be lived experience author and speaker Jim Mann, and we'll be talking about how to remove the stigma associated with dementia. So until then, thanks for your company, and take care now.